You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to The Past Macabre, where we journey through history to uncover how our relationship with death reflects the values, fears, and hopes that shape the way people live. I'm your host, Stephanie Rice. Thank you for joining me for episode 28, Ancient Fossil Finds and Mythical Creatures, Part 1, Here Be Dragons. Archaeologists and paleontologists are often mixed up in pop culture, which can be really annoying given that we have distinctly different periods and subjects of study. But sometimes our research does actually overlap because humans have been digging up fossils and keeping them as cool treasures for quite a long time. In the last 30-ish years, researchers have begun using interdisciplinary techniques to look more closely at fossils that have been found in archaeological contexts and comparing them to the broader cultural context that they've been found in. People who lived thousands of years ago came across fossils just like we do now, and honestly, they had first access, so they probably came across more. And they used their knowledge of the natural world to attempt to explain those fossils. Similar to how paleontologists in the 19th and 20th century reconstructed dinosaurs based on what they knew. And we've learned now that many of those depictions were incorrect. Up until the very end of the 20th century, we all saw depictions of dinosaurs as scaly, reptile-like creatures. But now that more dinosaur fossils have been discovered, we know that many of these depictions were way off, and a lot of dinosaurs that we previously assumed didn't have feathers actually did. The evidence that mythical creatures were based on fossils isn't only based on comparing the visual characteristics of the fossils that have been found in archaeological contexts with the descriptions of mythical beings, because there's a lot of conclusions that could be jumped to when just using that as the comparison framework. In this episode, I'll share the evidence that we have from texts and art as well, thanks to the ancient writers and artists who spoke or depicted the fossils that were discovered in ancient China, Greece, and Rome that were specifically said to be the bones of dragons. So with those sources, combined with the paleontological record that's been found in the places where those myths were originated from, we'll be able to kind of compare to see what dinosaurs were dragons, and sometimes it's not even dinosaurs, sometimes it's fossil mammals. So let's go ahead and dive in and begin our search for dragons.
Tales of monstrous reptiles or sort of reptiles are found in nearly every mythology around the world, but it's definitely a stretch to call them all dragons. Some are winged, some are purely serpentine, some have four legs, no legs, six legs. It's all over the place, all over the world. The word dragon comes from the ancient Greek word for serpent, drakon, and that was Latinized to Draco. Over centuries, that term was adopted by European scholars, especially during the Middle Ages, and storytellers latched onto it as well. So it became like a catch-all phrase for any sort of great reptilian being. So our entire concept of dragons has been shaped specifically by that Greek context. So dragon became the default term in Greek and Roman writing, and then Italian, French, and then especially English writing after that. But most of these creatures already had their own names and their own mythologies that didn't overlap so neatly to be able to categorize them as all the same sort of creature. The iconic Chinese dragons, for example, are called long. It's not an exact translation to call them dragons. That term for them actually came from Marco Polo, who visited in the 13th century, and he described his travels in Xanadu, which is modern-day Mongolia, and it was the capital city at the time. He referred to the long he saw in the palace decor as dragone, and those long have been part of regional myths for millennia, even before the first dynasty in China was even established, separate from anything related to what he would have known as dragone. A tomb attributed to the Yangshao culture was found in central China with one of the first recognizable depictions of a long. It dates to about 4500 to 3300 BCE. For context, the first dynasty, the Song dynasty, began around 1600 BCE. So on either side of the person from the Yangshao culture that's buried in this tomb, there are clamshell murals set into the ground. One is of a tiger and the other is of a long, which those are both now widely associated together as the embodiments of yin and yang. Shell murals are very cool, but why a real creature and then a mythical one? Maybe the answer is that they thought the long was real after all. Later texts and art specifically identify the white tiger as the symbol of power or royalty more than typical tigers. They were extremely rare in the wild, about 1 in 10,000 chance. And on top of that, their coloring comes from a genetic mutation. It only occurs in Bengal and Siberian tigers, and neither of those subspecies of tiger were found anywhere near the site of the tomb. The tigers that used to live there in central China are a much smaller subspecies, the South China tiger. They're no longer in the area, but I think they're functionally extinct in the wild, unfortunately, and they're heavily part of conservation efforts now in zoos. So hopefully something can be done, but they do not have the genetic mutation or even the gene that could be mutated in order to become white tigers. So if this archetype for the dragon and white tiger motif comes from this tomb, and then later we see the white tiger a real, but would have probably come secondhand, if not a very rare sighting indeed for the people of the Yangshao culture, then it's possible that the dragon concept also came from secondhand stories. Trade routes do carry far more than just physical goods. They also bring stories from far off places, and those can sometimes be adopted if they're interesting enough, or even if they're similar enough to their own stories that are at the place where they're arriving. There's a whole portion of research now that's been dedicated to studying this sorts of folklore transmission, and it's very, very cool, and honestly should get its own episode. But back to the dragons, there are texts that reference dragons that date to the very first writings in China that were found on oracle bones, and those are from the Song dynasty. The oracle bones themselves, as well as fossils, are all broadly referred to as longyu, which translates roughly to dragon bones. The first written description of a long comes from the 2nd century CE, and it describes them as having antlers of a deer, the head of a camel, eyes of a demon or a ghost, neck of a snake, the belly of a clam, scales like a carp, claws like an eagle, paws like a tiger, and ears like a cow. Some depictions and descriptions of long also say that they have what's called a qimu, which is a long horn or even just a lump on the front of their heads. And that's actually what makes them fly because they aren't depicted with wings. There are several megafauna fossils from modern Mongolia and China that easily match these descriptions. Some examples are an ancestor of modern deer that lived about 2.5 million years ago up to about 1 million years ago, and it had antlers that were shaped very similar to the way antlers on long are depicted, especially in a lot of the royal art that has been preserved. And there's also a long extinct three-toed relative of modern horses that lived about 10 million years ago called Hipparion. And fossils of their hooves look very similar to the three-pronged depictions of the antlers on long, which have the two smaller prongs on either side of the central prong that are slightly smaller but symmetrical. And on top of that, their skulls can look a lot like the skulls of camels that were native to the Gobi Desert at the time, especially once they were fossilized over time and then damaged by the elements. Makes it really hard to tell exactly what species it is, and you're going to match it up with the things that you know exist in the world around you. Some researchers have theorized that the horn-like Chimu was inspired by fossilized shells that belonged to orthoconic nautiloids, which are the ancestors of like octopuses and squids. And they had long, narrow, cone-shaped shells, exactly like the name orthoconic implies. And then it's also theorized that the lump-like Chimu could have been inspired by hadrosaur or ceratopsid skulls. Hadrosaurs are like the triceratops and that whole like horned and frilled family of dinosaurs. And then hadrosaurs are the ones with the sort of like horn-ish on the top of their heads. And that's the one that like kind of, it's been famously depicted using that sort of horn as a way to make loud noises and alert like the others in their herd. It's assumed they would have had herd-like tendencies, but anyways, their skulls and the ceratopsids that were native to Asia, especially Central Asia during this time period, they would have had those like rounded lumps protruding from their heads instead of something as sharp as the cones of the nautiloids. Researchers have also theorized that the scales, specifically compared to that of the carp, were actually probably fossil plants from the Carboniferous period, which was over 300 billion years ago, but we do still find fossils from these plants. And a species called Lepidodendron, the fossils for that have been found very frequently. And its name is Greek for scale tree because the fossils look exactly like scales with the way that the bark laid on the tree. When the fossils are preserved right from the bark, it easily looks like fossilized carp scales. So this connection between fossils and long doesn't come out of nowhere, and it's not even a modern theory. All fossils and ancient animal bones were called longu, which, again, roughly translates to dragon bones in modern English. And this was even during ancient and historic China. A text from 361 CE is the first documented report of longu specifically being excavated. They had been found during a construction project, and the name obviously stuck well into modern times because long after that, it's continuously referenced in texts. And then even sometimes in modern medicine shops, you can actually find it because longu became part of Chinese traditional medicine and they became super popular and sold in massive quantities. Since these were being sold in such massive quantities, there were clearly sources for these. So there are actually sites that have been found by archaeologists and paleontologists that show that there were ancient and historic excavations going on here long term in order to dig up fossils and then process them, store them, and then eventually sell them wherever needed. By the 19th century, fossils labeled as longu were so common to find in pharmacies across China that it's led Western researchers to identify many, many, many of the extinct species and fossil sites over there ever since. And so researchers started considering if that was the case in China and then several other places in Asia, then is that possibly the case in other places? There are also ancient Greek and Roman texts that reference fossils and ancient bones that were considered to be proof of mythical creatures at the time. Some authors voiced their skepticism and disbelief at the mythological origins of these massive skeletons, and they said that they had to belong to some currently unknown natural creatures, and some of them even implied that they were intentional hoaxes crafted by people who combined the bones of several common creatures. So it's amazing how much people don't change, considering that these types of paleontological hoaxes still happen today. One type of Greek dragons are called the Cetia, and or Ceti or Ceti in Latin. It's been modernized to most English speakers as Ceti. These were Greek sea dragons specifically, very specific to the sea. And Achaetos, which was the singular, was killed by Hercules at Troy, and the myth was mentioned as early as the 8th century BCE by Homer in the Iliad. And then there's later writers who ended up expanding on it beyond his brief mention of it. And as with all Greek myths that were perpetuated throughout many centuries, there is also art depicting the scene as well. One specific piece is a unique 6th century BCE Corinthian vase that depicts a fossil skull that seems to protrude from a cliff. I will definitely be sharing pictures because it most certainly looks like a skull, and given the context, it very much looks like a fossil. Paleontologists and biologists have been asked to study it, and many think that it's actually an extinct species of monitor lizard that used to live in Greece about 5 million years ago. In another myth, there was a different Ketos who was sent by Poseidon to kill Andromeda, but then the hero Perseus saved her and then killed that Ketos. And according to the myth, he did it using Medusa's head to turn the monster to stone. Almost like fossilization from bone to stone. Obviously, that is a leap. That's not what anybody ever specifically said when it came to describing the bones that were found later. While they hadn't necessarily mapped out the full process of fossilization, they would have definitely found these fossilized bones and tried to understand, based on what they knew of the world, how these stones and rocks became shaped like bones, or vice versa. According to Pliny the Elder, in the 1st century CE, the Roman politician Marcus Aemilius Scaurus managed to acquire the bones of the Ketos that Perseus had killed. It was widely accepted in ancient times that the story took place in the ancient city of Joppa, which is modern Jaffa in Palestine. Other writers said that seeing the bones of the Ketos and the chains that once held Andromeda was actually a tourist attraction there at Joppa at the time. Pliny reported that the spine of this creature was about 40 feet or 12 meters long, and that it had ribs taller than an elephant. Scaurus was said to have had the massive bones shipped from Joppa to Rome, which would have definitely taken a very long time, and then he put them on display to basically showcase this trophy of the famous myth of the Ketos that Perseus slayed. And then based on Pliny's description, researchers believe that it was a whale skeleton that Scaurus had on display in Rome, but it's not really clear if it was fossilized or not. And it may actually not even be from an extinct species. There's a chance that it was actually the skeleton of a regular whale that had beached and died not too long before the skeleton was collected. It would have been fairly rare for a cleaned skeleton to wash back up on the beach after a whale stranding, but occasionally it does happen, or at least the majority of the skeleton washing back up. And so this would have definitely been seen as a very interesting event. And given the fact that a whale skeleton just by itself is very hard to distinguish as a whale, it's pretty easy to see how they could come to conclusions about it being a monster, or at the very least, kind of twist the story into a tourist attraction about a monster. It may have even been intentionally reassembled to look more monstrous. Other pieces may have been added, because during this time there was a rush to collect and display the bones of heroes and monsters for prestige amongst the Greek and Roman elite. And as I had said before, there were several ancient writers who specifically called this practice out. And so that's how we know that generally during this time period, there's a high probability that this was touted as this monstrous creature instead of anything close to how it actually looked. Ketos was Latinized into Cetus over time, and then it eventually came to mean any large sea creature, real or not. There's a constellation Cetus that's known as the sea monster as well, so it's still commonly associated with just specifically sea monsters. And then Cetus became the origin of cetacean, which is the scientific word for whales, dolphins, and porpoises. And since the whales were likely the origin of many of the Ketos tales, it's all come full circle. There are individual drakon as well that are identified in Greek myth, like the drakon of Colchis and the drakon of Ismenos. One guarded the golden fleece in the sacred grove of Ares at Colchis. It was said to be in the rough area of the modern-day country of Georgia, not the state. It was said that the dragon of Colchis never slept. And this was so that it could guard over the golden fleece, which was a very, very, very rare treasure. It was killed by Jason and the Argonauts so that Jason could take the golden fleece to reclaim his kingship. The owner of the Golden Fleece, King Aeetes, ordered Jason to plant the teeth of that dragon and then fight the warriors that would grow up from the teeth, assuming that it would be a completely impossible task that Jason could not complete. But surprisingly, the dragon's teeth reportedly did grow into what are called the Spartoi, separate than the Spartans, and it translates to sown ones. Ultimately, Jason was able to defeat them, and then he was able to take the Golden Fleece. And then alternatively, the other dragon that guarded Ismenos, which was the sacred spring of Ares, the god of war. The legendary hero Cadmus stumbled upon it when he was sent by the Oracle of Delphi to follow a cow that was sacred to Athena to found a new city that would become the city of Thebes, the Greek city, not the Egyptian. After the cow led him to the spot where this spring was, Thebes was going to be founded here, and so Cadmus and his companions were resting, and Cadmus had two of his companions, sometimes more, escort the cow to the spring so that she could drink because she was exhausted from walking so far. They had no idea that it was sacred, and they had no idea that the dragon was there, and it sprang up and killed the sacred cow and the men that were with it so quickly, and Cadmus had to step in quickly and avenge them by killing the dracon. Athena also told him to sow the dragon's teeth so that they would grow into Spartoi warriors. And either because they were tricked into fighting amongst themselves, or because Ares attacked in retaliation for the death of the dragon, all but five of the Spartoi perished. And then those surviving five assisted Cadmus with founding Thebes, and they became the ancestors of the elite families of Thebes.
Ancient writers were already debunking this myth by the 4th century BCE. Pelephidus was actually explicitly calling these myths as originating in the finding of ancient bones, though he specified the teeth of very large, long-dead elephants. And it's interesting that he specifies elephants as the majority of these myths instead of the typical shark teeth. And so it must have been specifically due to the curiosity. Shark teeth are found in lots and lots and lots of places, whether they're fossilized shark teeth, regular shark teeth, all over the Mediterranean. There's tombs that have shark teeth, both fossilized and not, that have been altered to become pendants and other pieces of accessories. So he specifically calls out a different type of tooth that would have been even more eye-catching than previously, and they're much, much larger. And what we do know now is that there are straight-tusked elephants that used to live in the Mediterranean during the late Pleistocene. They went extinct about 44,000 years ago, so they would not have been having interactions with the ancient Greeks at the time, and they would have only had the comparison of the elephants that they knew from India and Africa. They would not have had any elephants roaming around by the time that they were there. So Pelophidas was close, but he didn't quite know how far they had been long dead. There are several more Dracons in Greek myth, but these are the ones with specific origin stories and evidence from multiple sources that they could have been associated with fossils. If we went through all of them and the comparisons, it would be multiple episodes just dedicated to Greece. So before this episode is out, I wanted to share some of the information that the Greeks started recording as their influence grew across the Mediterranean. And then Roman writers picked this up as well. They began recording the myths of the people in different lands, like Egypt, for example, but then they would add their touches to it. So according to Herodotus in the 5th century and Cicero in the 1st century, both BCE, there were Dracons in Egypt. They're generally translated to winged serpents whenever we get English translations of these texts, because we don't associate dragons with Egypt. And allegedly, according to both Herodotus and Cicero, these dragons of Egypt had all been killed by ibises, who were sacred to the Egyptians, and they were meant to protect the Egyptians from this incoming wave of snakes. Herodotus specifically says that he saw spines and ribs of serpents in such numbers that it was impossible to describe. There were heaps of ribs, some heaps large, some middle-sized, and others smaller still than these. And these heaps were many in number. Now, the ancient Egyptians did have winged serpents in their mythology, which is another reason why whenever we get the English translation, we just kind of get that winged serpent overlap. But they were seen as good and generally protectors, despite Herodotus and Cicero's claims, because they were associated with the protector goddess Waget. And she began as a protector of just a smaller region. And then her influence grew, and she's the goddess represented by the cobra that's on the royal crown of Egypt. That's why basically you have those winged cobras in every royal iconography, especially during the New Kingdom. But given that Herodotus specifies that he even saw the bones of these winged serpents, I wanted to dig a little bit further, because Egypt has some pretty famous fossil beds, like the Bahariya Formation and Wadi el-Hitan, which is called Valley of the Whales. The Bahariya Formation is where the first Spinosaurus fossils were identified. It's in the Western Desert. The spines along their backs and their tails could most certainly look like ribs, especially if the like cartilaginous sail that kind of forms in between them had completely gone during the time that it was found. And the Spinosauruses could reach 14 meters or 46 feet. And there's been several specimens studied by modern paleontologists, but only in pieces. That's after centuries of people knowing that they were there, going to the site. So they could have seen longer specimens, more intact specimens. And seeing that long spined body can very easily be mistaken for a snake-like body. And then depending on which direction the spines kind of fail over as the fossils lay in situ, can easily be mistaken as wings. And in some cases, small pieces of the sail that was formed in between each of those spines on the back can remain, and then those could look like wings as well. And then there's Wadi el-Hitan near the Fayum, which is named for the hundreds of near-perfect fossil remains of the ancestors of modern whales. These were called the Bilosaurus, and specifically, the ones found in Egypt are referred to as Bilosaurus Isis because they're named after the goddess Isis. They had very serpentine bodies that were 15 to 18 meters or 49 to 59 feet long based on these. And when I say like near perfect fossils, I mean like the entire bodies were preserved exactly as they were, the fossils fully articulated skeletons. Some were even so well preserved that their stomach contents were actually still within the fossil. So that's how archaeologists and paleontologists have been able to work together to kind of piece out what these sorts of creatures would have been viewed like in the ancient world. And paleontologists have been able to take it further and completely reconstruct their diet and learned that they were likely the apex predators of their period. They had huge crocodile-like jaws that were filled with very sharp teeth. And given the fact that the stomach contents of one actually contained another predator, it shows that they were most likely the biggest bosses of Egypt when it was underwater during that period. The shoulder blades for basilosauruses are generally very large and fan-shaped. Very easy to just take a look at, especially lying in situ right next to the spine, fanning outwards. It's very easy to see that that could have been a wing if you're looking at it from trying to compare it to the natural world around you and what you've seen. I wouldn't be surprised if you would hold up photos of their skeletons to just any passerby and ask them what they looked like, and they would tell you they looked like flying serpents. I thought the same thing when I saw them the first time. They're very cool. And given that we know actually going to see large bones were a huge tourist attraction in the ancient world, it's not an uncommon thing for the ancient writers from Rome and Greece to go to these places where they had heard about fantastical things and attempt to see them with their own eyes and then communicate that, like how Herodotus did, and he started specifying the bones were there instead of just Cicero's reference to them. So thanks for joining me for dragon hunting. There are so many more examples from Chinese, Greek, and Roman sources, so I'll be sure to share info about where you can learn more in the show notes and on social media. I love looking at the ways that ancient people interacted with fossils and the stories that they told about them, because it reminds me that we're all the same. Like, everybody loves fossils and everybody loves a cool monster story. In the next episode, we'll look at other mythical giants and monsters associated with fossil finds in the ancient world that aren't specifically called dragons. So, until next time.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe to keep up with new releases. Please leave a rating and a comment. That helps the show reach others who may be interested in the past macabre. For access to bonus content from all Archaeology Podcast Network shows, become a member at archpodnet.com/members. That's archpodnet.com/members. You can find show notes for this and other episodes at archpodnet.com/TPM and follow Past Macabre on Instagram. That's PAST_MACABRE. You'll find pictures of the sites and artifacts discussed, Q&A sessions, and episode topic votes. Hope to see you there.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.